This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Welcome to Books Uncovered, an exciting conversation about books and literary events, brought to you by the Dunedin Athenaeum Library and Mechanics Institute.
I'm Holly.
And I'm Bella.
Over the next half hour, we'll dive into themes ranging from romance to quirky book blurbs, all discovered within the depths of the Athenaeum Library. Kia ora.
Kia ora, everyone.
I'm in the studio with Bella, as usual. How are you going, Bella?
as most times.
Yeah.
I'm good. I've been enjoying researching a bit about our theme of the week.
Same. Yeah. I feel like I got really involved in this theme, which, so today we're talking about surrealism and magic. Magical realism, but also surrealism.
Yeah, they too often go very hand in hand.
When I think of magical realism, I think of, Gabriel Marcia, I can't even say his name.
Garcia,
100 Years of Solitude.
Yeah, that's kind of the, me too. I wanted to talk about that, but I read it years ago and I was like, I don't have time to reread it.
Did you like it?
I loved it. Oh. I remember I had a lasting impact on me, not that I can remember the book now, but I remember loving it and this has really made me want to reread it and revisit it. Did you like it? Or
There was a time when I was still living in the UK and I came back to visit New Zealand and everyone was reading this book. And then I tried to read it and I do what I usually do, which is I give a book 100 pages. And then I was like, no, this is just not for me.
Interesting.
But maybe it was just the wrong time as well. But to be honest, I haven't really been that much of a fan of Angela Carter, which is someone we're talking about today as well.
Mm, okay. So maybe you just don't like
the genre. Yeah, but I do enjoy some of it.
Yeah. I was reading a bit about it and there's, a lot of a big background in Latin American writing. So lots of the titans of the genre are from Latin America. I read a book by Jorge Luis Borges, who is people say he's one of the fathers of magic realism, called The Library of Babel. Or Babel, however you like to say it,
yeah.
Which I loved. I just read that. It's like a short story. But I feel like I need to sit with it for a wee while before I can feel smart enough to talk about it. It's like sort of about a library and the librarians in it that is just like a series of infinite hexagonal rooms that each contain like the exact same amount of books. And then the books are all sort of like a random generating of words. So some of the books are gibberish and some of them are incredibly profound. It's kind of like the monkeys on a typewriter theory where, if they type forever, eventually they'll create a work of Shakespeare.
Interesting.
But I'm excited to read more of his novels sort of further go into the genre. But should we say what magical realism is?
Yeah.
Because it is kind of a confusing...
Well, I came up with that it presents a realistic view of the world while incorporating magical elements and sort of blurring the lines between speculation and reality. And David Lodge, who's he's an editor and a novel, I can't find words today. He says it's a marvellous and impossible, when marvellous and impossible events occur.
I was thinking of a good example is from 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez, where there's a point in the story where a character is just ascended to heaven holding a couple of sheets. And as the story continues, it's never mentioned how wild it is that she ascended to heaven. But the woman who owned the sheets that she ascended with comes back to the family at multiple points asking for her sheets back. So it's sort of like...
That's great.
I also found a really good example, the best one, simple way to say it, it was on Reddit actually, where it's like, say you're standing in the city and a dog comes up and talks to you. The two of you have a little adventure and the adventure is the interesting part of your day, not the talking dog.
Mm.
I thought that was a really good way of just summing it up.
That is a good way of summing it up. I've been really enjoying, I want to talk about Leonora Carrington, who some people will know who she is, And yeah, she's an incredible artist. She was part of the Surrealist movement. She was born in 1917 to quite a like upper class family. She was really rebellious and didn't fit into school. She got kicked out of school for trying to levitate, for example. And there's like some wild stories of her like meeting the family priest and flashing him and saying, "What do you think of that?" And so anyway, she studied art. I think she went to Royal Holloway in London, and she met Max Ernst, who's, you know, famous surrealist artist. And they were seeing each other for a while, and then the war broke out, World War II. And because he was German, he was cast out of the UK. Mm. And then, but the Germans also didn't like him because of his painting, so he went to America, and she was apparently devastated. Anyway, she went to Spain, and then she got sectioned and was subject to shock treatment, and the family wanted to send her to South Africa, and they sent her nanny to take her there. And when they were in Portugal, she escaped and had an old friend that was a diplomat in Mexico, and they married for convenience, and then she moved to Mexico and spent the rest of her life there. So she lived a really long life. She died when she was 94, so she died in 2011. Yeah, so most people know her for her paintings, which are wonderful.
I love her.
Have a look. So this book that she wrote is called The Hearing Trumpet, and they're kind of unsure of when it was published, like when she started writing it, but maybe around 1976. So it tells a story of 92-year-old Marion Leatherby, who lives with her son and his wife and child. She's quite an eccentric old woman. She's got no teeth. She's got a friend that lives down the road that she goes to visit, called Carmilla. And Carmilla gives her a hearing trumpet. And this hearing trumpet means that she can hear, and she can hear her family. And she overhears them talking about wanting to put her into a rest home. But the hearing trumpet also sort of represents a few things. It's that she can hear the world, but also the world can blow into the trumpet at her. But it's also sort of a way of for her to hear the truth and the lies that people are telling her. She's got like two cats. She says things like, "Don't trust anyone under 70 or over 7 years old unless they're a cat." Her friend encourages her to save her cat fur so that she can knit a nice woolly jumper, so she keeps it in jars. So the family put her into this rest home, which things just become more and more surreal. Her friends constantly talking about breaking her out of there with like dogs and helicopters and ropes and stuff. It's quite funny, but there's some really poignant moments in it and observations about the world. Well, she says, her friend says, "It's obviously something extremely sinister about the rest home, a place where Marion cannot take her cats, as institutions, in fact, are not allowed to like anything. They don't have time." So the rest home's called the Well of the Light Brotherhood. And it's run by a man called Dr. Gambit. And all the residents live in quite like odd places, like a shoe and a French chalet, and there's like a castle as well. So it's sort of, the book explores themes of aging, institutionalization, female power, and mythological and transformative nature of imagination. I feel like my throat is so croaky. Anyway, I'm going to read a wee excerpt of when she's packing to go to the rest home. "One has to be very careful what one takes when one goes away forever. Something seemingly useless may become essential under specific circumstances. I decided to pack as if I was going to Lapland. There was a screwdriver, hammer, nails, birdseed, a lot of ropes that I'd woven myself, some strips of leather, part of an alarm clock, needles and thread, a bag of sugar, matches, coloured beads, seashells and so on. Finally, I've put a few clothes in to prevent things rattling around inside the trunk." And then she's saying about her daughter-in-law being nosy. She decides to fill up a few empty cardboard boxes with stones from the backyard and tied them up again with string so that she would think I left all my miscellaneous collection behind. Maria would call it rubbish and throw it away. But yeah, it's sort of, the tone is quite charming and quizzical, almost like fairy-like, which is very much the magical realism, sort of deadpan literism, open to the world and like matter of fact. It's been called a coming-of-age novel for someone who is dying. But yeah, I'll just read one more quote from it. I often feel I am being burned at the stake just because I have always refused to give up that wonderful, strange power I have inside of me that has become that becomes manifested when I am in harmonious communication with some other inspired being. But yeah, it is probably one of my favorite books. I wanted to read lots of quotes from it, and I had a trouble trying to pick one because it's
always a good sign. Like
dense with them.
Everything I want to quote.
Yeah. So yeah, she was also part of a founding member of the Women's Liberation Movement in Mexico in the 70s, and yeah, I heard some really awesome audio snips from her. Yeah, just talking about like interviewers asking about can women be artists. And all this sort of stuff. Yeah. She's very pithy and, yeah.
Stupid question.
Incredible woman.
Oh, it makes me want to learn, like, all about her. I'm going to, yeah.
Yeah.
Do some research.
Very cool lady.
Yeah. I had a lot of trouble picking what I was going to talk about this episode because I've read a lot of magical realism once I sort of was like, oh, that's what this is. But a lot of it I read a while ago, so I was like, I could talk about like Haruki Murakami, who I've read a lot of his work, like Kafka on the Shore, which I do really recommend. I loved that book. I read it when I was a teenager.
So did I.
But actually, I really liked how sort of he subverted like the traditional Orientalist narratives of Japan, and how like I liked how his like more surreal plot lines used Western capitalism, and it's like marvelous elements, like in Kafka on the Shore, when there's a supernatural shapeshifter who takes on the form of Colonel Sanders, as an example. So I would also recommend you read Kafka on the Shore, but I'm not talking about that today because I read it when I was like 17.
Yeah, I must have been about the same age, actually.
Yeah. So I've gone, one I read recently has actually helped get me out of a really terrible reading slump, is an example of a big, what you'd call in the bookshop, a big trend in literature at the moment, which is magical realism in Japanese fiction. But it's sort of more, it's light, what I would call light reading, or they're not hard reads, like Before the Coffee Gets Cold, you know that series? Mm-hmm. Sort of like, there's like a coffee shop where people go and sit, and then they can like, I haven't actually read them, but like you can like pick one part of your life to like revisit, I think. There's a lot of books like the one I'm going to talk about where it's like there's usually a talking cat involved, and that's sort of the magic. They go on an adventure. So the one I'm talking about today is called The Cat Who Saved Books by Sosuke Natsukawa, and it's translated by Louise Heal Kawai, which I thought is just a really lovely read. It's not a hard read in any way. I read it in a day.
Me too.
Join the club. It centres around a teenager, Rintaro, and his grandfather and guardian has passed away, and he's left alone as the proprietor of their second-hand bookstore, something he must soon leave behind to live with a distant aunt. Suddenly, Tiger, a magical talking cat on a mission, it's usually always a talking cat. You'll see if you come and go into any bookshop, if you look at this particular genre of book, there's always a cat on the cover.
There's so many talking cats. I mean, and then there's that whole like crime series where cats solve mysteries.
Yeah. And sometimes in the books there's not even a cat in the book, it's just on the cover. It's a real motif.
Yeah, like the hearing trumpet, the cats are just present because she talks about them again, and then they go to look at a friend. And
I want to read more about what cats mean, particularly in like Japanese literature.
I think they do represent like the other world.
Yeah, true. They can magical. Sort of bridge the gap between.
Yeah.
Yes. Anyway, Tiger comes up to this teenage boy and whisks Rintaro away on adventures to save books, and in turn learn he has a strength inside he never knew. this is also like, I just really enjoyed reading this. It also gives you like a really good reading list. There's lots of odds to older literature, lots of like Western classics. And it's just a really charming little book, which is quite empowering. It's a bit, it's a little bit like surface level, and none of the characters are all kind of generic. There's like the shy bookish boy, the overachiever girl, the athlete. But I think in this sense, they really mesh well and do like a good job of driving the story. And it's just, if you like books, it's just a really nice book about books and the power of reading. And yeah, it's a bit over sentimental and idealistic, but as someone who loves books, obviously I'm doing this podcast and work with books like all the time. It's just really, it's a nice book. I always recommend it to people at work. I'm like, if you just want a book that makes you feel good.
Is it, you know, I guess it's like entertainment. We're always talking about this thing of like, why read, you know, like, is it?
It's about that. It's like, sort of the power of books. There's a little bit of a critique on like sort of the mass marketization of books these days and how sort of the drive to read, like reach goals of reading rather than enjoying the reading. It's sort of like a light critique, but there's like that sort of interwoven with it as well.
Save the goals for reading for kids who are learning to read.
Yeah.
So you can get them excited about reading.
But yeah, I think it's a good one to start with if you want to ease into the magical realism genre, specifically in Japanese fiction, before you dive into something like there's like Hiromi Kawakami, I think, who I've also talked about her other book, and Haruki Murakami, who I think are a bit more involved.
I sort of think of Jeanette Winterson as well. You were talking about The Sheets, and I remember this, I can't remember, I think it might have been Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit from that book, where the character puts her hands in the air and she's holding bread and an eagle comes and she flies away into the air. And it's just kind of not really explained. It's just like, oh, okay. But it's all set in a very realistic world.
I love this genre. I just love when... And it's like, yeah, do you don't have to explain it. It's just...
I love some just elements of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't quite articulate what it is.
I think I like the
why
fact.
It works for some.
Yeah. I like the fact where it's kind of like this, it's like disregards the Western ideals of like narrative and things always need to make sense and sort of leans more into like folklore and maybe like more indigenous knowledge, which is why the Latin American books like
animals talking,
like things happening that are unexplained but do have like roots in like culture. And like one example I thought of was like The Bone People by Gary Hulme, which is another magical realism, and the stuff comes from like Maori mythology. And I'm like,
I quite like it in poetry, and actually, just from having this conversation now, I realise that I do it in my own poetry. Like, the collection I'm writing has a polar bear in it, but it's never really explained.
Yeah, love that. Does it talk, or is it just there?
She's around, but she just comes and goes. It stemmed from, because I don't know if you remember, there was a taxidermy polar bear in the Proctor's auction house.
Yes, I do remember
years
that.
Years ago, and then I had a dream about her, and she told me that her name was Becky. And so now she's a character in my book, and... but she doesn't speak, because then that would kind of ruin the illusion of, well, is she a person or is she a polar bear? But yeah,
it is Becky.
Those blurred lines of magical realism, I think, can be really fun. But I don't know, because, I mean, Angela Carter is someone we were going to talk about as well.
Yeah, we both brought Angela.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was the first one I thought of for.
Yes, same, as kind of a pillar.
I had to read her for the first time when I was in my first year of university. It was for, I had to read The Bloody Chamber for, I can't remember what paper it was for, but for English.
A little bit about Angela Carter is that she was born in 1940 and she only lived till she was 51.
Did she?
She died really young. She got lung cancer. I know, I was like, gosh, that's very young. But she was a short story writer, poet and journalist, and known for her feminist magical realism. But she's mostly known for The Bloody Chamber, which was published in 1979. And am I right in thinking that it got turned into a film or like a short?
I don't know.
Film?
I actually have no idea.
Yeah. I guess maybe I because it's so it would... visually rich.
Yeah.
That maybe that's what my memory's just like, it's a film because I can see the setting. But, yeah, shall we I'll talk a wee bit about the story.
Mm.
So basically, very short, in short, there's a young woman who doesn't have a lot of money and meets an old man, and he and her get married, and he's quite scary looking. Yeah, the way her descriptions of him, you're kind of like, is she describing like Count Dracula or something? Yeah. And then they go and live in a castle. Yeah.
The end.
That end. Yeah, it's kind of, yeah, it's quite a dark, eerie story. Other short stories by her I've also found to be quite unsettling.
They're all pretty unsettling. And
yeah, I got this book. It's like a short, it's a massive book. It's actually got a really cool cover. But I read The Man Who Loved a Double Bass.
I haven't read that one.
A short story in it. So it's a man who's in love with his double bass, and it's a touring band.
Mm.
But yeah, very dark and yeah.
Yeah, sinister. I read, I brought Nights at the Circus, which is a novel by Angela Carter, which is about a woman named Feathers, F-E-V-V-E-R-S, kind of a funny play on the fact that it's her coming of age story. She's a really tall Cockney young woman who's very larger than life and super confident, and she also is born with wings. That's where the magical realism comes in. Yeah, that's why I liked her name, Feathers.
Feathers.
Feathers. And she uses the wings to become an aerialist. And the story sort of follows her journey around London and her experiences with the circus and the performing. And I was watching a video about Angela Carter where she talks about this novel, and she talks about how performance is a metaphor for womanhood and having to play this prescribed roles in society. And so that was the function of Feathers being like a circus performer in this story. Yeah, I liked this book. It's I find her books quite hard to read just because there's always, like, I'm never sure like what pace to read it. It's like I have to read it fast, but then sometimes I have to read it really slowly. Otherwise, my brain just like, you know, she takes you off on all these tangents.
Yes, yeah.
Which is hard to follow because you're sort of like, every line is really beautiful and has all these like extra layers of meaning. And then if you zero in on that, then you sort of miss the overall, like the overarching themes. I'm like, it's a hard author to talk about for me.
Yeah, I find her quite challenging to engage with.
Mm.
I mean, short stories are a nice way in.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I think, so the Bloody Chamber is based on Bluebird, which I don't actually know that fairy tale, but yeah, all the short stories in that collection are based on, you know, Red Riding Hood and
Yeah, really interesting like feminist lens on
rewriting it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's a pretty, I recommend reading Angela Carter's books. I think the Bloody Chamber is a good sort of, yeah, as you said, it's a good entry point with just the short stories.
And
I did enjoy Night at the Circus. It sounds like I didn't like it, but it's hard to explain how I had trouble reading it rather with, but the fact that I did really, I enjoyed the process, even though I found it difficult and it kind of made me feel a bit stupid. But I liked that about it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's like that sort of part of the appeal of the story is
the challenge.
The challenge, yeah. And sort of that, yeah, it sort of makes you feel a bit dizzy. Like, this is like a kind of a spell on you.
Like a heady. Yeah. That is a good way of putting it. It is kind of like a magical spell.
Mm.
Yeah. Apparently she was, just before she died, she was writing like a part two for Jane Eyre.
Oh, that would have been so good.
I know. Yeah. Such a shame.
Damn. I wonder if anyone will
release her
papers. Seems to be a trend.
Is it Knights of the Circus?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. What's her other one? There's another one that is, I can't quite recall.
I didn't write it down either.
I got, I think reading The Bloody Chamber is like a good taste tester, and if you enjoy that, then you'll enjoy the rest of her work, I reckon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's a good, yeah, good thing to say.
So we're running out of time.
Do you have any events coming up at the Athenaeum?
We have the Masters, Otago University Creative Writing Masters end of year reading on the 19th of November, which I believe is a Wednesday. So all the students that have been on that are going to do a reading. It would be a good opportunity if anyone out there is thinking about doing the course to come and talk to some of the students about their experiences and to hear some of the results of that year.
You'll be doing a reading?
I'll be doing a reading.
Featuring Becky the Polar Bear?
I will be reading about Becky the Polar Bear, so welcome to come and join that. And, yeah, we've got an exciting book launch coming up too, which I won't say too much about, but because the date isn't confirmed yet. But I will definitely be talking about it.
Stay tuned.
When that's locked in. I could just talk about Leonora Carrington.
I really want to read that book now. That you've also got a lovely, got the actual book in the studio, and it's got a really cool cover.
It's got a great cover. Yeah, she's got her drawings scattered throughout the book as well.
Oh, amazing.
And they're pretty hilarious.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a novella size book, which I come to realize I love novellas.
Love a wee novella.
Yeah.
Let's dip a toe.
Exactly. It doesn't, it's not like an epic with 3, 4, 5 books. And
yeah. I enjoyed the cat book that I read because it was like, apart from that, read like 10 really intense fantasy novels. I was like,
that's intense.
I was like, oh, this is so nice.
A palate cleanser.
Yeah.
All right. Well, yeah. Thanks for tuning in and catch you next
time. Thank you, everyone.
Bye. Ka kite.
Books Uncovered. Exciting conversations about books and literary events. Brought to you by the Dunedin Athenaeum Library and Mechanics Institute.
Join us, Holly and Bella, every second Saturday at 12 p.m. as we dive into themes ranging from romance to quirky book blurbs, all discovered within the depths of the Athenaeum Library.
That's Books Uncovered.
Saturdays at 12 on ORFM and online at oar.org.nz.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.